This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Coco, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, The Man Who Invented Christmas, and Roman Israel Esquire. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, listener feedback, and the home cinema roundup featuring Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 39. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
In Thanksgiving weekend, I thought it would be nice to have one week where I wouldn't have to talk about sexual misconduct in Hollywood, but no, there's more stuff happening. And I want to point this out. I mean, yeah, I can sit here and talk about how the Death of the Nile was greenlit after the success of Murder on the Orient Express with Kenneth Branagh, but why not? Let's talk about more sexual misconduct. This time, John Lasseter is under the gun. And here's what I was originally concerned about with the Me Too movement is exactly happening right now. Because clickbait is what used to be what sells papers and what makes people click are these stories of sexual misconduct. So people are finding as many as they can. And I mean, I guess that's good because it is uncovering things. But now we're going from sexual assault to sexual misconduct. And we're starting to gray some lines and blend some barriers that is actually normalizing and hiding some of the real insidious stuff going on. You gotta be careful of your words. And when you start having to rewrite your words to reshape an argument just so you can get clickbait and have talking points, that's where it becomes a little bit dangerous. And I hate using the term witch hunt because that's been so overused, but the same thing that happened in the traditional sense of the Salem witch trials, where people got wrapped up in this hysteria and just started accusing everybody, that's to me what the Me Too movement represents. And I understand, yes, it's nice that people are getting a chance to have a voice, but we're having some unfortunate side effects. I'm becoming very leery of these inappropriate touching and groping claims. Especially ones that happen years down the line. And that's not that, I mean, I'm not questioning why somebody wouldn't say something at the beginning. I understand the psychology behind that. But I also understand that things are often remembered differently by different people in different situations. And there could be some selective memory. There could be some things that somebody took offense to that there was no intent of. And it can be in the possible political attacks. And you're seeing that with, and this is apolitical. I mean, you're seeing that with both Al Franken and George H.W. Bush. The questions of groping and, I have to question whether they were actually groping or if they just put their arm around him and their hand went to the wrong place or something like that. I mean, when you're a politician, you meet so many different people, whether you're Al Franken or whether you're George H.W. Bush, and you're taking pictures with literally hundreds of people a year, at some point you may end up brushing against somebody's buttocks. And some might be selective memory, like what's happening with Richard Dreyfuss and possibly even John Lasseter, where people are like, well, I didn't like what he did. He hugged me too much. He was too touchy. Like Richard Dreyfuss, who is being accused of sexual misconduct because of things he said where he thought was flirting. And the woman's like, no, it wasn't flirting. Or could it be that she acted like it was flirting? And now, decades later, when her writing career didn't take off, even though she was working with Richard Dreyfuss, maybe she is bitter about her. Maybe she just changed her story. Maybe she remembers it differently. And why didn't she say something then to him saying, look, I know you think this is funny. I just don't appreciate this. And what's happening is exactly like I predicted. People like Lasseter and Dreyfuss are being lumped into this category with like Weinstein and Ratner, who have actual claims of rape and sexual assault against them. Huge difference between that and somebody misinterpreting a hug. And it's the same way Franken and Bush are lumped in with Roy Moore, who has actual deeply disturbing claims of calculated and sociopathic child endangerment and attacks. Which is a huge difference from somebody saying, well, he kissed me without consent, even though in her own story she says, well, he bugged me about it. I said, okay, let's just get it over with. I hate to tell you, that's consent. And if you're going to go perform something on stage and actually have a kiss in a scene, you better rehearse that. That's not him being creepy. That's good rehearsal. And then when you say, okay, we'll do it, that's consent. It's a huge difference than some of the other crap that's been going on, like with Roy Moore. And I know I'm dipping into politics, but this is where it's like really driving, because, you know, whether or not somebody works in a movie studio is a huge difference than whether they become a lawmaker. Or like, you know, Louis C.K. and Kevin Spacey, where they're kind of somewhere in the middle, aside from Kevin Spacey's alleged attack of the kid who was 14 in his bedroom. Why he was in his bedroom in the first, I don't know. A lot of this stuff just sounds weird. It's like when the allegations against Bryan Singer, where the guy was like, they'd take me to these sex parties and I only did it for a couple months. It's like, whoa, why did you go back? Now, when it comes to John Lasseter, I don't know. I don't know the guy. I've never met him. But was he handsy? I don't know. Maybe he was. Did Lasseter hug a lot? I'm sure he did. This was the promoted culture of Pixar. It was sort of like the Google place to work, where everyone was loosey-goosey. But even the accusers didn't leave Pixar because of it. And supposedly Rashida Jones, who this kind of all came from, wasn't because of the sex stuff. Wasn't because of him being handsy. It was essentially maybe racial issues. And it's not like she was ever the voice of Black America with her tenure on The Office and Parks and Recreation. I mean, yeah, she's the daughter of Quincy Jones, but she's just as privileged as any other white person out there. I had originally predicted that what you're going to see is sexual harassment verbiage and agreements coming up in movie contracts. The way businesses do it now, where they have a practice and they have a way of reporting and they have what's appropriate and what's not. But actually, what I wouldn't be surprised seeing is if entertainers start to include non-disclosure agreements saying that by working here, you waive your right to complain about off-color jokes and anything that happens outside of the workplace setting. Now, you can't waive neglect or criminal actions, but you can basically say that if you work in a comedian somewhere, you can't get offended at dirty jokes. And you can't complain about being asked out when you're not on the clock. Heck, that's what I would do if I was in charge. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two really quick I want to talk about. Deadpool 2 has a trailer, which is a lot of fun. It's based on an old Bob Ross bit. If you don't remember him, he was the guy who did all the paintings and Happy Trees. But they dropped this. It doesn't give you anything about the movie, but it's a nice little teaser for some comedy.
Hello there. Welcome back. I'm glad you could join me today. Let's just dive right in and we're going to get a little dab of our yellow snow here. We're going to mix that with just another little dab of our Betty White. Okay, let's paint in a few little happy trees there. Nothing wrong with making friends with trees. Now, what you don't want to do is eat these paints. Trust me on this one. So from our family to yours, keep your pants dry, your dreams wet, and remember, hugs, not drugs.
I love these kind of teasers because they don't give away stuff in the movie. They show some clips and stuff, which you can go online and look at. But overall, it's not spoiling stuff. It's just Deadpool being Deadpool. And that looks very funny, especially, but now it kind of makes me want to watch some of the Bob Ross shows. I actually started watching, I got wrapped up into watching a Bob Ross episode after I pulled this trailer, which is, I guess, what it meant to do. The next one I want to talk about is The Incredibles 2, opens on June 15th.
You have powers! Yeah, baby!
Now, this one actually became known because it was the most downloaded animated trailer, I think, ever. And it's only a minute long and not a whole lot happens to it, but it's all about Jack-Jack. And I remember Jack-Jack was a lot of fun. And even in the Incredibles DVD and Blu-ray, they have like the little extra short film. Anyways, that's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Man Who Invented Christmas and Roman J. Israel Esquire.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews and let's kick off the Christmas season with The Man Who Invented Christmas. Charles Dickens searches for inspiration for his new Christmas novel after his last three projects flopped.
It's about a miser, and on Christmas Eve, he meets some kind of supernatural guides.
Does it have a title?
Humbug, a Miser's Lament.
Christmas Ghost Story, Christmas Song.
Christmas Ballad, something like that. Get the name right, and the character will appear.
Scratch. Scrounger.
Come on. Scrooge.
Shut the window. You think I'm made of money?
Mr. Scrooge, how delightful to meet you, sir.
Sorry, I can't say the same.
Every movie that comes out that has a Christmas theme to it is like, oh, a new holiday classic, an instant classic. And sometimes these movies will pick up and then end up becoming a perennial favorite. And sometimes they just become a Christmas movie that kind of gets logged into a book somewhere. What's funny about these is, and I've noticed this as a trend, Christmas movies tend to become classics based on how often they're aired on television. It's not the movie that comes out that becomes a classic. It's the fact that they, It's a Wonderful Life slipped into the public domain, and it was played throughout the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And then finally, there was a studio that pulled back and ended up, I think they ended up getting the soundtrack. They got the rights to the soundtrack, which meant you couldn't play the movie without the soundtrack. So they essentially have the rights now exclusively to It's a Wonderful Life, so it gets one airing a year. But the same thing happened with A Christmas Story. A Christmas Story became a classic, not because it's such a great Christmas movie, although it is, but because it got played so much on television, especially, I think it was TNT, played it constantly in the 90s and in the early 2000s. Elf is the same way. Elf's probably one of the more recent Christmas favorites that has become a classic Christmas movie, and Elf gets played on that 25 Days of Christmas all the time. Don't go looking for Holidays in Handcuffs with Joey Lawrence and Melissa Joan Hart to become, well, considered the new classic, even though that gets played all the time. But The Man Who Invented Christmas, I don't know if it's ever going to get to that level of a classic Christmas movie, because I don't know how available it's going to be on television. I don't know if that's even going to define it now in this day and age of streaming services. But it is definitely has a Christmas feel to it. And the story is about Charles Dickens as he develops the piece. Now, it stars Dan Stevens as Charles Dickens, and you might recognize or maybe not recognize Dan Stevens from the biggest movie of the year this year, which was Beauty and the Beast. Of course, he played the Beast, so he was completely CGI'd out, and he's a lot less hairy in this movie. But he plays Charles Dickens struggling to keep up with himself as a writer, and it feels a little bit like, you know, sort of like the whimsical angle that Shakespeare in Love took, where Shakespeare was a contemporary playwright to his own fame. I mean, he was having to answer to his critics, and he was developing. Shakespeare wasn't the bard that's become immortal that he is now. And in Charles Dickens, he was just a popular author at the time. And there were other authors he was in competition with, and it was him trying to come up with something new each time. He didn't know he was going to make this novel that would kind of redefine the modern Christmas. And I think it's a little bit of a stretch to call it The Man Who Invented Christmas, because I don't think he necessarily invented a lot of this. And if you look at it historically, Christmas was already there was a wave of celebrating Christmas coming back after a big puritanical push against it, especially in the States, but, you know, in London. But the Christmas surge was already starting to happen, and it was kind of right place, right time for Charles Dickens. And it was him trying to get this book out in like 6 weeks. And so it's kind of an interesting look at what his life was, but it's not in this overly drab and humdrum. And some of these period pieces can be really, you know, they want to show the desperation of the time as well. But this is nice and friendly, and it's neat to watch him wrestle with the characters. You know, he imagines them in real form. I mean, he has whole conversations with Scrooge, which is played by Christopher Plummer. Don't worry, it's not that Kevin Spacey once played Scrooge, and now they've got Christopher Plummer. Christopher Plummer had always played Scrooge in this movie. So, but those are interesting things, watching him deal with, and really kind of, it's one of those movies where the second half is better, because the second half you really start seeing the book come together, that becomes the annual favorite that we all know. But overall, it's a fun movie. It reminds me not of a movie I'd see in the theater, but it reminds me of something when I was a kid, like in the 70s, and I go to my grandma's house, and we'd be watching TV, and you know, as we're leading up to the Christmas time, and we watch, like, you know, whatever the holiday special was, where they have variety shows and stuff. You'd watch the Muppets, and then there'd be something you'd swerve into. Maybe it was on an independent station. Maybe it was a smaller movie, and we'd all sit and watch it, and it was a Christmas themed movie. And that's what this reminds me of: something you'd watch on TV with your family rather than necessarily going to the theaters. But it doesn't mean it's not worth checking out in the theaters this week if it's playing in your neck of the woods. So I'm going to have to say The Man Who Invented Christmas, I think, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Roman J. Israel, Esquire. Denzel Washington stars as an ambitious lawyer struggling to be an independent voice for activism and working within the embattled court system.
The world is a ghetto. Voluntary manslaughter, it's a good deal.
It's an enema of sunshine.
Sorry for
taking a nanosecond off of your assembly line rubber stamp existence.
This law firm has run a deficit for years.
You're firing me?
You were a cornerstone of activism. You're inspiring.
I'm tired of doing the impossible for the ungrateful.
I have to say, I was looking forward to this movie. I like Denzel Washington. I think he's a great actor, even though he sometimes kind of plays the same character over and over again. And it was directed by the guy who did Nightcrawler, which came out a couple years ago with Jake Gyllenhaal as sort of like that real sleazy news reporter who started interfering with the news to make it bleed more, so it leads more. And that was a neat movie. It was depressing and sort of nihilistic at times, but this one has at least the trailer certainly had the same power to it. And then it started, and I was like, what, are they going to screen this? And then I got in touch with my local rep, and I said, hey, are they planning on screening this? Eh, we're not activated for Columbus. And generally, that's a bad sign, especially if it's something that should get some sort of award traction. If they're not screening it locally, and I mean, like, everywhere locally, I mean, if you live in, like, small town, 1,000-person population town in the middle of Kansas, yeah, maybe they won't screen there. But if you live in a major city, and Columbus, Ohio is a major city, and they're not screening it in Columbus and only screening it in, like, Cincinnati and maybe Cleveland, that's a bad sign. That shows that they don't have a whole lot of confidence to it. And then I asked, we got awards coming up here in a couple weeks. Are you going to send a disc to me? Nah, yeah, well, we'll try. I'll ask him. I never heard anything from the studio. I mean, I got every other Sony Pictures Classic DVD that they're pushing. This, apparently, they're not pushing. And probably with good reason. It's got 54% on Rotten Tomatoes going into the weekend. This is not the treatment of a movie that the studio has confidence in. So I imagine that this movie is marginally okay to watch if you're interested in it, but ultimately I don't think it's a big movie, and I think it's probably going to be forgotten. I mean, it's like The Darkest Hour. I've got a screener of The Darkest Hour. That thing just is in 2 theaters this week, and I think in a couple weeks it goes wide, but they made a point to send that out. Nope. Roman J. Israel, Esquire is being left out in the cold, so it's got to get a preemptive suck, because they made no attempt whatsoever to show it to me.
It sucks.
That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Coco and 3 billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the other big movies that are opening this weekend. And the first one I want to hit is Coco, which is probably going to be the big one this weekend. Pixar movies tend to do really well this weekend. And, you know, with the downturn of Justice League taking a little bit of a hit for its second weekend in a row, Coco's probably going to lead the pack this weekend. So this is, of course, the big movie. A young boy is reunited with his deceased family members on the magical Day of the Dead.
What's going on?
I'm just dreaming.
Welcome to the Land of the Dead.
Dr. Clean up!
You gotta stay with me, boy.
This isn't a dream, then.
I know your great-great-grandpa. I'll get you to him.
There's no one left in the living world who remembers you. You disappear from this world.
But you can change that.
We gotta find my great grandpa.
You gotta do it by sunrise.
What happens at sunrise?
You'll be stuck here forever. What?
This is obviously based on the Day of the Dead, which is a Mexican holiday. It takes place in Mexico. And it's about a young Mexican boy. He wants to reconnect with his great, I don't know how many greats are, two or three greats, grandfather, who was estranged from his family when he left his great-great-great-grandmother. And because that guy was a musician, they wouldn't let anybody sing. They wouldn't let anyone be musicians in the family, even if they have a natural talent for him, and as it goes down the bloodline. And so on the Day of the Dead, he wants to reconnect with this great-great-grandfather. And so he accidentally gets transported to the Land of the Dead. Now, first of all, look, I want to say this from a cultural perspective. It takes place in Mexico. It's a Mexican story. And the Day of the Dead is a Mexican holiday. It's not as creepy and weird as it sounds. It's actually a very uplifting, happy, festive time. It is the time when people remember those who have passed on in their lives. And while they have a skeleton imagery, like when the kid goes to the Land of the Dead, everybody's a skeleton. But it's not like creepy skeletons. They're colorful and happy, and they just happen to not have any flesh or organs. They're just skeletons. But, you know, they're brightly colored, and the Day of the Dead is a huge festival down in Mexico. So it's not a George Romero zombie movie, which you might be tempted to think. Even they did a movie called Land of the Dead, I think, or Day of the Dead, or something like that, a couple years ago. I think Fox did it. Now, it had Guillermo del Toro producing it, and it was an animated film. And it used a lot of the same motifs and a lot of the same ideas. And of course, it had the backdrop. But it was likewise, it presented the Land of the Dead as a somewhat uplifting, you know, happy-go-lucky place. It's just everybody's a skeleton. So even though it's a Mexican-based story, it takes place in Mexico, it's a Mexican family, there's a lot of themes that are universal. I mean, it's got themes about family and about forgiveness, about doing the right thing. It's the story of finding where you came from and, you know, reconnecting with your past or your family's past. These are things that anybody, you don't have to be Mexican, you don't have to be Latino to understand these ideas. And that's what makes a good movie, is when there's universal themes, even if it's done in a very specific cultural story. And like any Pixar movie, it's very well done. It's gorgeously animated. Takes a little bit of time to get into. I have to admit, it was, you know, the first 20-30 minutes aren't my favorite. I thought it was kind of slow. Once he gets to the Land of the Dead, things pick up and it's kind of cool. But leading up to that, the plot of the movie and the pacing just doesn't quite work for that like first half hour. But like with any movie, if you're going to have a stronger beginning or a stronger ending, it's better to have a stronger ending. Now, this one has a very strong ending. Well, like I said, once he finally gets to the Land of the Dead, which happens well before the halfway point, It becomes a very visually stimulating, interesting movie that's got some neat stuff happening and the characters interacting, and you know, it's a lot of fun. It does get at times a little bit dark, and like even for the storyline, because it is dealing with death, and that can sometimes be a little bit of a trigger for especially Americans. But I think we can learn a lot from this by learning how to deal with death the way this movie presents it. And it's a sweet movie. It has some very tender moments. It has some parts that'll probably make people cry. It's not too long, although there is, it's supposed to be paired with the Frozen short with Olaf. I think it's like Olaf's Christmas Adventure. They didn't show it to us. It wasn't in my screening, but apparently that's a significant short. It's not just a 3-minute bit. So if you didn't get enough Frozen a couple of years ago, there's the Frozen short at the beginning, and that's going to make the running time of the full shebang from the beginning to the end of the movie. That's going to make it a little bit long, but Pixar never has shied away from doing movies too long. They're not afraid to make a movie 1 hour 45 or 2 hours. They don't always have to keep it under 90 minutes. It's not my favorite Pixar movie, but you know, if even the not my favorite Pixar movies are pretty good. So I'm going to have to say that Coco rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Frances McDormand stars as a woman who rents three billboards in her small town to get the attention of the police, whom she feels has dropped the ball in the case of her daughter's rape and murder.
Still no rest. How come, I wonder? Because there ain't no God and the whole world's empty and it doesn't matter what we do to each other? I hope not. I don't know what the police are doing. I've heard an awful lot from them since I put them billboards up.
The more you keep a case in the public eye, the better your chances are getting it solved.
And take me down and arrest me.
They got nothing to arrest you for.
Not yet, you ain't.
This is probably the first movie I've seen this year in award season. Maybe if you want to count Disaster Artist and Lady Bird in this as well. But this is like one of the first one that I really think is worth the award hype. Frances McDormand, first of all, is fantastic in this movie. And I give her a lot of credit because she has struggled to get good roles. And she gets good roles all the time. It's nice to see her get one that's not from her husband, who was one of the Coen brothers. But she's fantastic in this movie. It's a very dark character, and it's a very nuanced performance. It's probably one of the best female performances I've seen this year. She shows a lot of grief and empathy and struggle with her own emotions. And this isn't necessarily about the investigation of the rape and murder of her daughter. It's about her coming to terms with it and the aftermath. Now, this is directed by the same guy who did In Bruges. If you don't remember that one, he also did Seven Psychopaths about 4 years ago, three, 4 years ago. So he's a little bit of an alternative style. What I like about how he approaches this movie is all the characters, you see them going down a certain path. And he will change that trajectory. And so where you think all the characters are going, they end up somewhere different. I mean, like every single one. And it comes as a surprise for all of them. And that's, I think, what's so well done about this movie is it could have been a big load of trite garbage, but it's not, because it focuses on the characters and development of each one. And it's not a police procedural. It's about how people react to that. Woody Harrelson's also in this movie, and he does a great job. He plays the chief of police who has his hands tied with what he can do as the police. She's upset because there's no traction on the case of her daughter's murder, but there's only so much that the police can do if they don't have any leads and they've kind of exhausted everything they can. And what's interesting, again, you think that his character is going to be this racist police officer who's going to battle with her the whole time, and he's not. He turns out to be a very nuanced character. This is kind of a banner year for Woody Harrelson because he has such a great turn in his role in War for the Planet of the Apes. And this is a great way to bookend the year with this film. I wouldn't be surprised, a good supporting actor nomination for him, possibly a supporting actor nomination for Sam Rockwell, who's fantastic in this movie, a best actress nomination for Frances McDormand. This is a strong movie. The less you know about it, the better it is, because it is so surprising. And it's a movie that looks at some ugly aspects of humanity, but in a realistic and non-judgmental way. And it always allows somebody to have a moment of redemption. So I'm going to have to say that Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I've got a listener question to answer, talk about the box office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 39.
Stop it now.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that we've finished with the movie reviews, and now for something completely different, let's answer a listener question. This comes from our good friend, Red State Gabe, out in the red state of Arizona. And he asks, do they allow three-hour movies in theaters anymore? I have been told they are forbidden, even though I've seen plenty of them in the past decade. First of all, I don't know who told you they're forbidden. That's a loaded word. I mean, forbidden by whom? Forbidden by the theaters, by the studio, by law, by the Catholic Church? I don't know. It's not that they're forbidden. The way movies work is they want to show it as many times as they can in a day. This is less of a problem now than it was like 20, 30 years ago before they really had the multiplexes. I remember when I was a kid growing up in Columbus, Ohio, the largest theater in town was... It was called the Westerville Six. It was a six-screen theater. And then there was one in the Continent, I think, had four screens. And then there was a mall on the north and south and east-west side of town. And I think originally they had two screens, and then they went to four screens in each one. So it was not uncommon to have a theater could only play a handful of movies. Even like the one, the Westerville Six was tons that could only do six movies. And like the Continent, I think, expanded to seven. And then, you know, then it started to get ridiculous. Then in like Dublin, I think had there was a 12 screen theater that then eventually got expanded to an 18 screen theater. We have a 30 screen theater in town now. So the problem of playing the movies isn't as big of a deal because you can book them into multiple theaters. You know, like, you know, when there's a big movie like Coco, I imagine at the 24 screen or the 30 screen theater in town here, I imagine it's going to be on three or four screens, especially for a big weekend. It used to be that 3 hour movies bothered a lot of movie houses because a 3 hour movie, you could only, you know, if you're open 12 hours, you can only show a 3 hour movie like three times a day because you got the trailers in front of it and then you got time between it. And so in a 12 hour day, you can only show it three times. Whereas a 2 hour movie, you can show what, four times, sometimes five times. And if you have a 90 minute movie, you can show it, five or six times maybe. So the problem with the 3 hour running time is you didn't get as many show times, and that didn't bother the studios as much as it bothered the theaters, because generally you only sell concessions to a group of people once. So if you have four times you're showing a movie and it's in a 200 seat theater, say you sell out each one, you only have 200 potential concession customers four times a day. So only 800. But if you can show it five times, you would have 1,000, and you would actually make more money on concessions, which is where theaters make all their money. I remember back in the 70s or 80s, I remember there was a kind of a little bit of a scandal happened in my hometown of Columbus where somebody was running their projectors like 5% faster for a movie to fit in an extra screening. So it's just that they're not forbidden, they're frowned upon, and generally a long running time like Blade Runner, I think the long running time helped negatively impact Blade Runner's audience. You're asking people to either stay up late or find more time in the day. So it's not that 3 hour movies are unallowed. It's just there's kind of like there has to be a good reason, but that doesn't mean that we don't get 3-hour movies. I mean, good God, the Transformers movies are like 3 hours each. Mostly Christopher Nolan movies tend to be really long, except for Dunkirk because it was such a short film. But you get 3-hour movies all the time. Are you going to see the 4 or 5 hour movies like Return of the King? Those are a little more rare because that really starts stressing the butt cheeks in terms of keeping people in the seats. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. And the Justice League won last weekend with almost $94 million, and Wonder came in with almost $28 million. Now, the disparaging reporting is, even though Justice League made more than 3 times as much as Wonder did, the narrative was Justice League bombed, Wonder is beloved by everyone. Okay, first of all, from ticket sales alone, more than 3 times as many people went and saw Justice League than Wonder. So that doesn't mean that it's this juggernaut. It's just that Wonder didn't cost all that much to make. Wonder had carries a budget. Oh gosh, I don't even know what the budget is. It's probably like $10, $20 million. Justice League has a $300 million budget. And I think people are saying, well, it bombed. Yes, it bombed. Well, yeah. I mean, it didn't do well in America, but it did well. We're in a weird place where a movie can make $94 million in a weekend and be considered potentially a flop. It's not a flop. It's a disappointment. It didn't make as much as they wanted, but it's like I've been saying all year, like with the XXX movie, like with The Mummy, like with Transformers, you got to look at the international box office. Justice League made almost $300 million its opening weekend worldwide. Now, that's not breaking any records, but it's halfway there already. And it all depends on how well it plays out overseas. And it also depends on what kind of legs it has going into Christmas and whether it sticks around after Christmas. I think it's going to run into the biggest competition with Star Wars. But you know, the Justice League will probably get close to $200 million domestically. And if it makes $400 or $500 million overseas, which is entirely possible because that seems to be what these movies do, it's fine. I would not start having a bake sale for Warner Brothers in order to cut the Justice League's loss. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is just in time for Turkey Day weekend, and that is Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 39. Now, this is important because it's essentially, I believe it's the last DVD release of Mystery Science Theater. Now, I think there have been about 150 episodes released on disc, which is a lot, but they had almost 200. Before the revival took place on Netflix, they were just like, what, like 198. So there are still a couple dozen episodes that are not released on DVD. And that's kind of a shame because some of these movies are kind of hard to find, and a lot of it's it all boils down to a rights issue, because originally when they made Mystery Science Theater, they just got the right to air it. They didn't get the right for DVD. They weren't looking ahead to DVD distribution. It took them a long time to just get VHS distribution. And even then, they only had a handful that they released on VHS, especially when they were airing them, and you could get reruns all the time. And I think right now, Shout Factory has kind of been like, this is all we can do. They can't do any more. And so there are a couple, you can still find them out there. You can find a lot of them on YouTube if you're missing key episodes that are not released in the Shout Factory box sets. You can find them on YouTube. Sometimes you can find them on your old VHS tapes. I still got a whole bunch that I'm converting to disc. But in this pack, they're all 3 Mike movies, by the way. If you're a Joel fan, there's a little bit of Joel in the 4th disc, but the releases are Girls Town, which stars Mamie Van Doren and Paul Anka. And what's interesting about this is Mamie Van Doren actually made an appearance on their Turkey Day celebration back in the mid-90s. So it's got a little bit of Turkey Day history there. And this is a fun one. This one that has no science fiction or horror element to it, but it's one of their authentically hilarious 1950s romps. There's also The Amazing Transparent Man, another Mike episode, which is, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's I think, in Mike's first year, so he's still getting his footing. And then there's Diabolik, which is the final episode of the series itself, which is kind of a nice way to put the final group of films on DVD. You put the very last one on there. It's actually a Mario Bava movie, and it was the last one they ever did on Sci-Fi before they did the revival on Netflix. And it includes a retrospective on the series, and in particular that sci-fi run. So it's nice. It's an old one. It's been released before, I think, either on DVD or on VHS. But it's nice to see a retrospective from like the early 2000s of what it was like when the show eventually went off the air. But the real gem in this is the fourth disc, which is called Satellite Dishes. And what they are, they're extended cuts of host segments throughout the year for both Mike and Joel, like starting with like Rocket Ship XM and going through. There's like 3 hours of host segments. And that can be a little bit wearing to watch 3 hours of host segments, but it's neat to see these extended versions of them that had to eventually either be cut or reshot for time in the show. And it's nice to see stuff that maybe hit the cutting room floor that wasn't either aired or got scrapped for something shorter. So it's a nice little gem in there. Like I said, 3 hours of it. So yeah, that's kind of the fun little, you know, nice little bonus that you get. Now, all of them, speaking of bonuses, have the original theatrical trailer for the movie and Ballyhoo does these retrospectives of each of the films. And then that's it. I mean, that might be it for Mystery Science Theater, but at least there's new episodes coming out. You still got the other ones on Netflix. They'll probably be doing a season two. But if you're looking for the old ones, look at YouTube, or as they say on Mystery Science Theater, keep circulating the tapes. The final selection of Mystery Science Theater 3000, volume 39, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
The other releases on DVD and Blu-ray this week include The Hitman's Bodyguard, Valerian and the City of 1000 Planets, Birth of the Dragon, Leap, and Good Time. And that is it. I need to go and eat some turkey. Tune in next week when I'll be talking about The Disaster Artist. Until then, have a fat time at the movies. Gobble, gobble.